Jesus Castillo was born in Mexico, and he moved to California with his parents in 1998. He graduated from the University of California at San Diego, where he studied literature and writing. And he is an organizer of Electric Collective, an art and poetry collaboration in the Bay Area, and founding editor of Vertebrae. He has lived in Oceanside, La Jolla, Oakland, San Francisco, and he received his MFA in poetry from the University of Iowa. Jesus Castillo, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Thank you.
And I have to say, I've enjoyed reading your first book, Remains. Really, I don't want to say non-conventional, because to say conventional or non-conventional is really kind of, you know, a very restricted, limiting term. But this book is different from most of the poetry books that I pick up. It doesn't have titles to individual poems. Each of the stanzas kind of stand alone, but they just kind of, you know, ultimately paint this huge picture of something. I'm not even quite sure how to explain it. So why don't we start with, how did this book come about? Why is it structured the way it is? You have like part one, and then you have several stanzas, and then part two, several stanzas, and et cetera.
Well, the book is a serial poem. At least that's how I thought about it in my head. I was reading a lot of poetry at the time that was kind of book length, mm-hmm. and structured with the book as the kind of structural framework. You know, instead of individual poems, mm-hmm. you have this idea of something that is the length of a book. And, you know, the serial poem is something that I was interested in. I was reading Ben Lerner and Ron Silliman especially, which, you know, Ron Silliman especially tends to focus on these long poems structured in, mm-hmm. in kind of various, sometimes like really strict mathematical ways. But I don't know, the serial poem for some reason was really interesting to me at the time. I wanted to attempt a book, but I didn't want to attempt, I don't know, for I wasn't interested in single poems. I wanted to write something mm-hmm. big, and the serial structure seemed like a good way to do that, like, you know, maintaining individual sections that hopefully stand alone, but that together make something larger. So that's what I wanted to do, and I set out sort of with the intention to try to do that, to come up with a form that could sustain itself for the length of a book.
Just to clarify for our listeners who may not know what a serial poem is, is this a particular genre, serial poem, and what are the attributes of this approach?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is a type of poem. I mean, a lot of people have written serial poems, and a serial poem is basically, you know, a poem in sections, you know, a series.
Right.
You know, kind of like the sonnets, you know, the original like sonnet cycle form is, I guess, a kind of serial poem. But a lot of poets have, you know, worked with the form, and I think one of the guys that stands out in my head is Jack Spicer, was writing in the 60s or 50s. You know, he was mm-hmm. with the Beats, but he didn't really like the Beats too much, and he was certainly doing his own thing. And he wrote a lot about serial poetry, and in his sort of definition, one of the attributes in his definition is that a serial poem could go on forever. It was something that, you know, had a form, and you could sort of repeat the form in sections sort of until you got tired of it or until you had nothing else to say, you know. So, right. So it's kind of a mechanism for continuing a poem that you can repeat, you know, as many times as you like. And the form itself can be as strict or as loose as you can manage to make it. Mm-hmm. But that's the idea, a poem that is in sections and then it could sort of continue on.
Yeah, you said that you set out with the intention to write a serial poem, which is kind of an interesting approach, because I know sometimes when poets begin a book, they're not quite sure really what it is that they want the form of the book to be. But after following the language or following the image or even just writing a series of poems over a period of time, they begin to see the form of the book. And I'm wondering if you knew that this is what you wanted to write before you started writing, where the surprises came for you in terms of the structure of the book or maybe even the poems themselves or the sections themselves.
Well, the surprises for me came from the actual lines, you know, from the language in the poems. So, you know, once I figured out this each page in the book has three stanzas, you know, and each stanza is separated by a little dot, and each stanza is sort of its own kind of contained sort of treasure box or something, its own little thing. And I wrote each stanza on like a little index card. So that was like the space I allowed myself for each thing. And I wrote the sections just carrying these cards around for 2 years.
And
I wrote, you know, whenever an idea or an image came up or struck me, I would just take out a card and fill it out. And most of them were filled out just in one go, kind of writing as intuitively as possible. So once the form was figured out, then I didn't have to think about the form anymore. And the surprise just came in, you know, seeing what came up when I took out one of these cards and filled it out. And a lot of it was written, a lot of the poem was written in transit, you know, in trains or buses or just at random moments. So the surprise was just, you know, being attentive to whatever might come up.
I'm talking to Jesus Castillo, whose book-length poem, Remains, has recently come out. And that's interesting that you would, like, write in trains and you would write in as you're moving across the landscape, because really what's wonderful about this book is you're not really rooted anywhere throughout the entire book, but you're constantly rooted. You're constantly rooted in landscape. You're constantly rooted in imagery. You're constantly being pulled back by the language. The language just has this wonderful way of just pulling you back into the poem. And so we feel like we're moving across a landscape, yet at the same time, it's a weird window we're looking out because we are seeing a lot. And I'm wondering, as you would pull out these 3x5 cards and just start writing these lines down, if you ever found yourself landing on a particular image and wanting to return to that later, or unconsciously or even consciously returning to it later, and what that might have meant for the experience as a whole.
I never thought about that, really. I think that there's obsessions in the poem that it keeps coming back to. You know, there's like separate strains in the poem that you could probably identify. Like one of it is like memory and childhood, and another one is like this weird urban, technologically saturated, you know, first person in the present. Right. And then there's like dreamlike stuff. And then there's stuff that's just pure play. But I don't know, I think images of like technology and the city came, you know, kept coming up. I didn't really think about them or anything, you know, plan them. It was just sort of like this, the different kind of obsessions or ideas that kept cycling in and out of my head as I was writing this thing for those 2 years. Probably like the city and technology is, you know, that kind of imagery is everywhere in the book, I think.
And you have some beautiful images here. I'm going to read one, a couple of my favorites. A red leaf blows in from the sidewalk and settles on the hardwood floor of a sandwich shop. Lights turn green. So it's a beautiful image, not only because it's so vivid, but also it kind of places you there. And I'm sitting in this, you know, this shop, looking out a window in a almost, I want to see a small town kind of thing, you know. But what's wonderful is it's almost, now that you tell me about the 3x5 cards, I almost see you pulling out the 3x5 cards, and as you're writing, you look out the window and you write down what you see. Did you do that occasionally? Did that happen?
Yeah, I mean, I wrote these things in like all sorts of places. I think that definitely happened several times. You know, images, I think, are one of the ways that these stanzas begin. Some of them don't begin with images. I think some of them begin with little musings or sort of ideas that pull you into the poem. But a lot of it does use a lot of imagery, and it's part of that exercise of paying attention. You know, I was reading Ron Silliman at the time, and he did a lot of stuff of, you know, writing in transit. He has that poem, Bart, that he wrote while he was riding the BART, you know, the subway system in San Francisco for an entire day, just kind of writing down his impressions or whatever. But yeah, like images are stuff that can root you, definitely, that can kind of remind you of where you are and kind of place you back into your body and put you at attention so that you can then begin to think about other things. You know, I think it's a common technique for poets. I'm reading Celan's biography right now, written by John Felsteiner. It's a really good biography. And one of the things that Celan says about poems is that poems are gifts to the attentive or something like that. If you pay attention, sometimes a poem will will be given to you or something like that, you know.
It kind of reminds me of this concept that philosophers have been articulating for centuries, that music is the highest form of art. And, you know, you can kind of speculate as to why many of them would believe that, including, you know, one of my favorite writers, Jorge Luis Borges, would always reiterate how music is the highest form of art. And I think about that, and I think that when you listen to a symphony or when you listen to music, it's almost as if the syntactical structure of the notes are pulling you in. And as they pull you in, your imagination could go anywhere. You could be, you know, in a sandwich shop watching a red leaf fall on the floor. You could be looking out a window at a landscape. Your imagination is not limited. And in a way, poetry strives to be the same way, I think. And this book, to me, is like music, because I can be sitting in a sandwich shop and suddenly I'm somewhere else. And even though you are able to direct our imagery, our landscape, you know, our imagination more so than music, and so perhaps it, you know, is more constricted than a symphony, nonetheless, you're able to take us anywhere. And I'm wondering how often in the writing process you're just writing and the music of the language, and I noticed, you know, you have particular musical tropes throughout, but how the music of the language can take you somewhere that you didn't expect to go and even lead you to non-imageless images. I don't know if that makes sense to you.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's tricky because, the question is how often. I mean, I don't know how often, but I think pretty often, probably constantly, my writing was dictated by what sounded good next. And, like, that's annoying in a way because, you know, it's not rigorous. Like, you know, poetry, if you let it be, it can be such a whimsical art akin to music. You know, and music strives for sound and pleasure, and not necessarily for ideas.
Right, right.
For moods and stuff, you know. And I like the idea that poetry can be a way of thinking, not just a pleasure system.
Right, right.
But also a system for thought, for accurate thought, not just whimsical thought. And the danger of following the musicality of the words is that you can end up with a line that isn't true, but it sounds nice.
Right.
Or it isn't profound, or it isn't even relevant or good, but it sounds good. And I think that the trouble with poetry is to not let it be too seductive if you care at all about truth or about insight. But it is music. It is supposed to be pleasurable,
right,
and sonically pleasurable. So I think, I was constantly sort of led by the sound of the words. You know, Ron Silliman used the metaphor in an interview about, like, snowboarding. You know, like, a snowboarder going down a slope has to, like, maneuver his way down the slope, like, moment by moment, based on what instinctively feels right at the moment. And it was the same thing kind of writing this book, trying to go sort of without thinking too much, but being led by the words. And I think that that was definitely something that I had to also balance with, like, trying to say something that felt true, not just sounded good. And it's tricky. But yeah.
And were you ever at any point attempted to write a narrative through line, an arc, so to speak, that is not imagistic or linguistic, but a narrative arc? Did you ever find yourself having to fight that sometimes where we try to impose a narrative?
No, I didn't. I don't think that was ever, like, a problem or a temptation for me. I mean, there's narrative stuff in there.
Oh, absolutely.
It's fragmented and it's sort of contained in its own moment, you know. And I was never attempting to write an epic in the traditional sense.
Right, right. Other than the very last part of the book, when suddenly we have these one stanza or one poem of 10, 11, 13 lines on each page, and they almost look, you know, visually, they almost look like sonnets, but this whole last part, just one, bam, one, bam, one, bam. Other than that last part of the book, could you rearrange the stanzas within the parts and maybe even the parts themselves and still have the same book?
Well, no. It'll be a different book maybe, but you could certainly do it. And
right.
I think that it might not even be a worse book. It might be better. Who knows? I think that's sort of another thing about the serial poem is, and I think Spicer talked about it, that in an ideal serial poem, you could rearrange the sections and it would still work, that they're not chronologically bound and they could still interact with each other and augment each other in various arrangements. So I think that is something that you could probably do with this book. And for, you know, when I read from it at readings, you know, often I'll read like five pages, but I'll select different selections from different parts of the book just for fun.
Right.
See what new effects I can come up with by combining words on one, you know, sections on one page. The way that the book is arranged now, I think, does have its own arc. And I don't want to, you know, I won't say what I think it is.
Okay.
I think maybe that
it's
more of a kind of a, not emotional, but like a change in mood, I think, from the beginning to the end of the book.
Yeah.
And it is sort of more or less chronological. And I think that arrangement works for me, and I think it's its own thing. But it could certainly be played with and, you know, produce other arrangements and stuff.
Have you ever read Abraham Smith?
No.
I was just Googling poems one day. I forget how, but I stumbled upon him. I think he was in the Poetry Foundation. And I read his language, and I really loved it. And so I bought his book. His latest one is called Hank. And I suppose you can call this a serial poem, but I don't know. Again, I don't know the form, if there are attributes that I'm, you know, that I'm unaware of. But it's one long poem, but there's no. It's not separated by stanzas. There's not a single punctuation mark in it. And I want to read you just a section because I want to ask you a question about this. Or actually, I think more. I want to make a statement about what I like about your book so much. Fred Rose and Hank Williams in a writer's room, and ain't nobody ever has known what went on behind that leaden-handled door, the great wide door, that whipping walloper that is already a great fat lie, for the door was a papery thing. It was one of those after-the-war doors, the South after-the-war doors. It was a door that apologized for itself when you shut it, still harbored a certain hurt and insecure sweet tea, etc., etc., etc. And he goes on the entire book like that, and frankly, it gets incredibly exhausting. As much as I admire the language and can ride some of those, you know, rhythms for a long time and let the images pop out at me, it's exhausting. And what works about your book, despite the fact that, you know, some of us crave a narrative through line or crave some sort of, you know, landscape that we're going to have our feet on for a period of time and begin to figure out where we are, because you're not going to figure out where you are in yours because you're everywhere. But what makes it work, I think, are the stanzas are very consistent. The parts are very consistent. And the syntax, the sentences, each sentence is self-contained. Each sentence lets you stop and start again. And you don't just kind of like just, you're not really all over the place, although you are all over the place. And then the sections. And I just think that's a wonderful way to keep your reader interested and say, okay, reader, I'm going to take you pretty much anywhere you want to go. But the craft to me seems very reader friendly. This is a very readable book. Did you intend to make it that way?
Well, I mean, that's good to hear. I don't know if I intended it that way. I mean, I just want to write something good, and I wanted to write something that I would want to read. And I think that I agree with you that, I mean, it sounds like Smith's poem is just a long poem.
Yeah.
And if you have these highly, highly dense lines that are super lyrical, and they just go on and on and on, that can be exhausting and harder to read. It's not necessarily bad.
No.
I wanted something that was more, like you said, more grounding. I wanted a poem that could work as a kind of really solid time machine or a really solid transportation machine that could take you places. And, you know, the hope is that you look up from the book and you feel your senses slightly sharpened or something, you know. But I didn't want it to be just long and drawn out. I wanted to have good pace and to be able to keep the reader, you know, focused and centered.
Right. And what's fantastic is you could put this book down, go have dinner, go out for drinks, and then the next morning pick it up exactly where you left off, and you just immediately fall back into it. I think you can do that with some books that don't have, well, with Hank. I don't think you can do that with Hank. And the other thing I'm thinking about is if you ever go to a party and ask somebody, although I don't know why you would go to a party and ask them this, have you ever read Finnegan's Wake? And they say yes, they're probably a liar. You know, the thing is, I think the only people who have read Finnegan's Wake, and maybe not even in its entirety, are those who write about it. Even though the language is amazing, it's one of the most amazing linguistic experiences you can fall into or immerse yourself in. And I think that, you know, with Hank, you know, that book that I referred to, that's going to be the case. But with yours, I read the whole thing from cover to cover, and I want to read it again. I'm going to read it again because it just pays off so much. So I don't know how you did it, but I understand why this book is getting the attention it deserves. It's really a beautiful, beautiful work of art.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
You said something in an interview. I want to kind of get you to extrapolate on this a bit. You say, one reason I don't like a lot of contemporary poetry is that I find it too solipsistic and cryptic. What do you mean by this?
Was that kind of a cryptic thing to say? you know, I guess a lot of, and this is not good because then I'm going to maybe sound like I'm talking about all contemporary American poetry, and I'm not. There's a lot of stuff that I do like, but there's also a lot of stuff that to me feels like willfully unambitious or like willfully, I don't know, hermetic or something. You know, like basically it's so abstract or so focused on like the personal that, you know, it's only interesting if you happen to be interested in the poet's personal philosophy or personal aesthetic. But it's so specialized and so kind of narrow in its obsession that it feels almost like irrelevant to most people's lives. And I'm not trying to write for most people, you know, but just I'm trying to write for somebody who's maybe like me, I guess, you know, like somebody who's interested in the intellectual exercise of reading, but not necessarily so. I don't know, a lot of especially academic poetry seems so like inward and so self-involved or contained that like that it's hard to read it because it's hard to like care about the same stuff. I guess it's I don't know if that makes sense.
No,
I hope I'm not coming off as like a jerk or something.
No, it makes complete sense. And one of the things about solipsistic poetry or poetry that is, the reality is really kind of dependent on the poet, and you have to kind of get into the poet's mindset, and sometimes you may not want to do that for whatever reason. But what's wonderful about, I think, what you're talking about is poetry where it could land temporarily in the, you know, the solipsistic perspective of the poet, but then it's going to go out again and it's going to fly around and it's going to land here and there, and all you need to do is ride the language and it'll take you to fantastic places beyond the perspective of the poet.
That's the hope.
Will you do me a favor, would us a favor, will you be willing to read a little bit from this book?
Sure. Well, I'm just going to open to a random page and read those sections, if that's okay.
Absolutely.
Okay, so this is from page 70 in the book. We were stuck in a canvas of splattered days, restrained flumes of feeling breaking against buildings, digesting ourselves, growing insane from ourselves. I wanted to stand like the sea cliffs. I wanted to step outside of my mind's door and be under an open sky, be where the unrestrained sits still. In the lit hallways of familiar houses, our steps echo. I take hold of the edge of the old desk and the dusty light of a summer and breathe. Burning these flowers day in and day out is beginning to drain me. All this ash, where to hide it? Through closed eyes, I see you arguing in an empty field. As if it were your first dead animal. As if we were made of glass and had been tossed in the air for a lifetime. As if we could forget entirely that we'll eventually reflect light and dull waves. As if part of us could stay in the spaces we leave. As if time weren't coiled inside you. As if our hearts could find some larger form to contain them. As if we could unlace from our bodies. As if our objects could forget us and become their own music box world. Everything comes back, whether or not you've managed to change in the intervening hours. Our non-choices too fling us ahead. Today in our screens, live shots of resistance under fire, a brief scene from our trip to the island in October, spines cracking as backs stretch in the morning. If only we could be as prepared for the day as we are once the day's been through with us, naked toes against hardwood floors, voicemails waiting in the wires.
That was Jesus Castillo reading from his book, Remains. Oh, and I got to ask one more thing. I got to ask one more thing, because after writing this, what are you going to do next?
What am I going to do next? Well, you know, I finished this book 5 years ago or four years
ago. Oh, wow.
You know, I started it when I was 23, and I finished it when I was 25, and I'm 29 now. And what I've been doing since then is, you know, reading and experimenting with other things, you know, new forms. So there's, two things that I have in my head, sort of, that I've been thinking about in terms of poetry, one of which is to find a way to write a poem that is in a larger voice than this one, I guess. I don't really feel like the same person who wrote that book. I guess I'm more interested in ideas and such. And I've been reading a lot of Mahmoud Darwish. I don't know if you've read him.
No, I haven't.
Oh, he's fantastic. He's one of the two great, you know, modern poets in the Arab language. He's a Palestinian, and he has these poems that are like 10 to 40 pages long, and a lot of them don't have breaks. You know, it's more of a continuous breath. They have stanza breaks, but they don't have the breaks like I do in my book. They're continuous long poems that speak in this like large first-person voice that manages somehow to contain the voice of just the human being. You know, it's a much larger voice than anything that I've read in contemporary American poetry, probably since Whitman. And Whitman was limited by the fact that he was in kind of a nationalist voice. And Darwish is one of the guys that manages to transcend the national voice and become this like speaker for the human. I guess I wanted to try to go in that direction without lying to myself, you know, about my own capabilities. You know, I think it'll take a while to get to that point, if ever at all I do get there.
Hey, Jesus, thank you for joining us on Words on a Wire. Wish you the best of luck with this amazing book.